This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There has been a shortage of affordable housing in Charlotte. According to a recent study, there is a deficit of about 15,000 units. But recently, Charlotte City Council voted unanimously to give developers a density bonus for building workforce or affordable housing in affluent parts of the city. These units would be for purchasers who make 80% of the area's median income and for renters who make 60% of that income. So what impact might this have on our shortage? Will developers be willing to take advantage of these density bonuses? And how will the neighbors react? We talk about that with Pamela Weidman, Ken Zemanski, and Fulton Meacham. Pamela Weidman is Assistant Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte, which is responsible for affordable housing, code enforcement, as well as economic development. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Obviously with us in our Spirit Square studio, along with Ken Zemanski, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Fulton Meacham is CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority, a quasi-governmental agency responsible for administering federal housing vouchers. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Pamela, define affordable housing. What is it?
Affordable housing is housing for persons or households earning 80% and below the area median income. And when we speak of 80%, that is for a family of four earning about $52,000 a year.
So they have to earn 80% of that $52,000 to qualify for affordable housing?
The $52,000 is the 80%. Yes. Area median income in the city of Charlotte today is about $64,000.
What is life like for a family of four earning $52,000 a year?
Those are many of the families that we see every day. That's the school teacher. That's the entry-level firefighter. That's the entry-level police officer. That's many government employees. So it's people that we see every day. It's people that we leave our children with at daycares. So it's the average working family.
So that puts a whole different picture on what affordable housing is and the people who need it. And use it. I would think that most people are. I'm surprised to hear that a teacher needs it or that a firefighter needs affordable housing. What does that say about us?
It says that, you know, when it comes to affordable housing, we are the people that need affordable housing.
And is that the case across the country, or is that particular to Charlotte because the cost of living here is higher, perhaps, than it would be, say, in Shelby?
It's definitely across the country that we have working families that need affordable housing. And in the marketplace right now, it's just very difficult to find a lot of that particular housing.
What's an apartment cost in Charlotte? I have no idea. What's the average apartment, decent apartment cost?
About $780 a month.
And what would that do to a family making $52,000? And what kind of an apartment do you get? Is that a one-bedroom?
That would be a two-bedroom apartment, okay. And that would be maybe a 15-year-old apartment in a middle-income neighborhood. And the household making $52,000 a year could afford that quite comfortably. In fact, they could probably afford $900 a month quite comfortably.
Are there a plethora of those, or are there not very many?
There is a plethora of those. There's a good supply. There's hundreds, if not a few thousand, in that rental strata. That folks who are making, say, 60 or 70% of AMI can't afford without any public subsidy, without any public help.
Why then do we have a shortage?
Well, I think one of the aspects is that looking at the geography of the city, it's been a public policy for some time that folks of middle income, the opportunities to live in the higher income neighborhoods aren't there. So part of this density bonus gets toward the goal of spreading households of modest means into more affluent neighborhoods. And the difficulties of doing that in terms of the response from neighbors and elected officials, the heat that they take, the community debate that we've had for a number of years about that issue.
There are hundreds of new apartments going up around town, particularly in the South End area along the light rail. Are those going to be affordable?
Those are all going to be market rate, and they're going to be fairly pricey. They're going to be in the $1,000 to $1,500 a month, and none of them are tied into any public subsidy program. They're all market rate, and it depends. And a lot of them are one and two bedrooms, too, and actually a large share of them are one-bedroom apartments. So it's not tied into the affordability of housing much. It's market rate housing. Any efforts at trying to incent those developers to include affordable portion haven't been successful to date very much, with one exception. So those are largely market rate apartments.
So let me tell you what I just heard and see if I understand this, that affordable apartments that would qualify for affordable housing and the needs of those who need affordable housing and who can actually afford these without a subsidy are in older units that are 15 years old or older and not particularly located in all parts of the city. So the commute for those people may be onerous if they have to live in one part of the city and work in another part of the city, and that the new units coming online are not priced in their price range.
That's exactly right, Mike. Right. That's what you heard. And so that's the beauty of this density bonus. That's what we hope to capture from new development, that new development in more affluent areas, that developers will set aside a number of their units for working families, families who need affordable housing. So, for example, the family who works at the Ballantyne Country Club, for example, they can live close to where they work and not have to make a commute from, say, East Charlotte or West Charlotte to work at the Ballantyne Country Club.
But Ballantyne is expensive. I mean, the property in Ballantyne is expensive. It was designed to be expensive. It was designed to attract higher-income people and put higher-income residences and things like that on that property. How do you convince somebody to build something lesser than that? And because the return on investment would be less than what it would normally be.
Right. So we're not advocating necessarily that they build something lesser, if you will. So, for example, a new multifamily development, where the density bonus would allow them to be able to develop a larger number of units or an increased number of units. And the idea would be to set aside at least 50% of what they gain through a density bonus for working families, for affordable housing.
We're going to talk about this density bonus here. The density bonus is simple. Tell me what it is. I mean, it's not money. What is it?
Right. The density bonus is a tool. It's another tool in our toolbox. Developers, if they're going to build a multifamily development, for example, they can, through a by right density bonus, based on what the city council passed, they could include an increased number of units in their development. So they get to build more to compensate, if you will, for the affordable units. Those affordable units won't realize the same rent.
So you're changing the zoning laws, essentially.
Right. It's a text amendment to the city zoning ordinance.
So if you're a developer and you've already been okayed to build a set of apartment buildings or, I guess, condominiums, some of these units could be for sale and still be affordable. Is that correct or is that
wrong?
And you could put, say, 30 units – three per acre on the site that you're developing. If they agree to build affordable housing units among those units that are being sold or rented at full price, they're going to be allowed to build more than they would normally on that same piece of land. What will that do to density?
That would increase the density.
What would it do to traffic flow?
Well, that's a great question, and we work with some of our colleagues in CDOT, and they ran a few models, and they have determined that it would not increase the traffic flow.
But there are more people living there in more units. Why wouldn't it increase the traffic flow?
Well, many of the people who live in the affordable units may not necessarily have cars.
Okay. So now if you have 30, you're building three units per acre. I don't know how to say this because I don't know how to do the arithmetic on the radio so people will understand it. But if you're zoned for three units per acre and suddenly you agree to this density bonus, how many extra units will you get to build? If you're building 30 apartments, how many more could you build?
Let me jump in because the examples in the ordinance are for 8 units per acre or 12
okay.
units per acre. So it might be 160 can go up to 200 apartments. Or it might be 240 apartments could go up to 300 based on basically up to one-fourth more would be allowed based on the density bonus. So there is some economy of scale in terms of the land acquisition cost, but developers would assert that appliances aren't significantly cheaper when you go from, say, 240 to 280 or 300. And other aspects of the building, construction cost, lumber, sheetrock, et cetera, is not appreciably cheaper. So while the development community applauds the density bonus approach and applauds the city of Charlotte in general, we're a little skeptical about the real impact of the zoning density bonus by itself, incenting and motivating development folks to act.
So when they build these units, be they for rent or for sale, are they identical or are the units being set aside for affordable housing going to have lower-end appliances, lower-end floor coverings, et cetera, things like that?
But, right.
I'm sorry, but, I mean, so we've at the Housing Authority, we have done a lot of this mixed-income development, and the whole idea is to make all the units look the same. You're building a market rate product that happens to have an affordability metric within, inside of it. So all the same appliances, all the same building materials and et cetera will be used in this particular development. You won't be able to tell the difference between an affordable unit and a market rate unit. And what we're talking about here is trying to really build communities that are seamless from the standpoint of being able to identify individuals that actually need the affordability for them to actually rent those apartments. And so from the outside world, we have some examples like First Ward that used to be Earl Village that you won't know which unit over there is a unit that has that's affordable between the market rate unit. And you know, to address some of the issues that you had as far as community perception about it, you won't know right now. Most people don't even know that First Ward had this particular affordability in it as we speak today. And it's a great community. It's well managed. And some of those stereotypes that are associated with affordable housing, we should look at those type of developments like a First Ward or Arbor Glen and et cetera, so that we can show the public that these are sustainable, they're well run, they don't take down property value as some things that I've heard. There's no evidence that has been produced that says that.
Well, we talked about some of the people who need affordable housing being people like teachers, mm-hmm. like entry-level firefighters, et cetera, who don't make enough money yet to be able to live in a different situation. But wouldn't affordable housing also be available to people who make considerably less than teachers or firefighters and who perhaps don't have a track record of responsibility?
Right. And that's what Fulton does so well at the Charlotte Housing Authority. I mean, his clients, some of them 30% and below area median income, they certainly need affordable housing and they need a chance to prove that they can be responsible tenants.
Exactly. So we have a program called the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, and where we work with these residents and position them through life skill training, job skill training, and et cetera. We work with them to get them on the track for to live in these type of communities. And I look at that as a population. We serve about 22,000 people within the city. And we look at that as an opportunity to really build this population for the housing that we're speaking of right now, of mixed income housing. Because I do completely believe that we have to provide some level of supportive services to transition those individuals into working families. And so that is more conducive for them to live in this mixed income community and attract the mixed income population.
So what you're saying is that those people who would qualify income wise for this property will also be qualified in terms of their readiness to live in a situation like this.
Correct. I think it's important for us to make sure that the supportive services are there in place, because we don't need any cases where, you know, it fails. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that the individuals that go in there fully understand the expectations about living in a mixed income community.
Fulton Meacham is CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. We're also here with Ken Zemanski with the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association and Pamela Weidman with the City of Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. And Charlotte Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Associates, providing complete eye and ENT care for the last 90 years, offering comprehensive care for infants to seniors in eye and ENT, as well as audiology, allergy, and sleep medicine. Details at goodsenses.com. Well, during the last election, as in many elections before that, we faced choices for candidates running to be judges at various levels of our state judicial system, and most of us go into the voting booth knowing little to nothing about these people, and on top of that, they don't campaign. So why do we do it this way? Some believe it's the best way to do it. Others believe it's a travesty. We'll talk about it from both points of view tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Montana's House of Representatives passed a bill that could imprison doctors for assisting in suicide. Legislation is pending in other states to make it legal. Debate over end-of-life laws.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing and specifically about the density bonus that the Charlotte City Council recently voted unanimously to use as an incentive for new development of affordable housing. We're here with Pamela Weidman, Assistant Director of the Neighborhood and Business Services Section of the City of Charlotte, Ken Zemanski, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, and Fulton Meacham, CEO of Charlotte Housing Authority. And Frank in Matthews is on the line and has a very good question, I think, that needs to be asked at this point in the program. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a great show. My question has to do with those buyers who are seeking to buy an affordable unit. Let's assume that I can qualify, and I buy a unit, and the next year my wife finishes law school, and now she's making $200,000 a year. Do you throw me out? That's the first question. Second is this. Same situation. I do qualify. I buy a unit. And I hit the lottery, and I just won $5 million. So that changes my economic situation. So what happens?
Go ahead, Pam.
Thank you for that question, and that is a great question. This is a new program for us, but we certainly talked a lot about that with the Citizen Advisory Group who helped us work through this text amendment. And we don't want to penalize people for their situations changing. We certainly know that luck happens every now and again, and people better themselves. So we recognize that situations will change and that people, the first buyer, will benefit mostly from this. We are discussing in terms of program administration how we will handle that. If the city will have the first right of refusal to buy that property back and to have it remain for affordable housing for that next buyer.
Are you saying that's an if, or that is a fact?
That is a fact. The city will have.
So if you purchase a piece of property under this program because you qualify under this program, and suddenly your circumstances change for the better, and it's time for you to move up to something better or whatever, the city will
have the option to buy it back. I mean, we want to
at the market price for affordable housing, or at the market price that I, the owner, want to sell it to you for?
It will be somewhere in the middle. And like I said, this is a brand new ordinance. We're still working out the details. But what I want to leave listeners with is that this ordinance does not penalize people. This text amendment does not penalize people for bettering themselves.
If I buy this unit under qualifications that allow me to buy a house or a condominium, I need and require affordable housing, and this is available, and I'm going to buy it.
Correct.
And I live in it for a year or two or three, and it comes time for me to move to something else. I get a new job someplace else. May not make any more money, but I'm moving to a different job in a different city. And I put the house on the market. Does it have to go on the market as an affordable house, or can I put it on the market at market rate?
You can put it on the market at market rate.
Why? That's a windfall, isn't it?
It could be. It could be a windfall for the person.
Why would we do it that way when we're talking nationally about means testing for Social Security and Medicare?
Well, like I said, Mike, this is a new program. We're working through it. We've talked about in the Citizen Advisory Group modeling it after a program we call the House Charlotte program. So, example, the House Charlotte program, if the person moves out of that house between year one and year five, they have to pay the city back any down payment assistance they received. That is written down at a 20% per year criteria, year six through 10. So that is our goal, is to model it like that after that program.
What about a rental unit? If I'm in a rental unit and I vacate the rental unit, does the rental unit stay an affordable housing rental unit, or does the developer then, or the complex owner or whatever, have the right to then turn around and say, well, it's been a rental unit for the first 3 years, that guy's getting out, and now we're going to make it a regular price unit?
think the ordinance calls for a 15-year period of affordability. You commit, once you get that zoning density bonus, you're committing for 15 years to keep it as such. And I don't think you have the right to sell the property. Or if you do, obviously it affects the economics of the value of the property from the investment standpoint.
Because a new buyer of a complex would have to adhere to the same rules.
Yes.
Right.
What has been the reaction of the apartment community to this ordinance, to the idea of this ordinance?
It's potentially a good tool, but it's unknown, and we're a little skeptical about how it'll materially deliver units going forward.
Is this done anywhere else in the country, or is this a first-of-its-kind program?
It's done in the country. Most cities do it as mandatory inclusionary.
Right.
We did not do that. We believe we need enabling legislation to do that. So this is a voluntary density bonus. It is not mandatory.
Will this be only for totally new developments, or is this something that, say, I own a 15-year-old apartment complex and there's a little park in the back, a little playground in the back where I could build maybe five or six more units if I took the swing set out and did some other modifications. If I wanted to do that, could I do it and make it affordable housing? Or is it only for new construction, new development?
This is primarily for new construction.
Why?
Well, it's
there's infill everywhere.
Right. As Ken said, there are a lot of existing units throughout the city. So this ordinance is for new construction.
Now, developers, the last time I checked, do not lose money. They are not in the business of losing money.
Exactly.
So if they're going to be in the business of supplying identical units to people who are paying the full freight, as well as to people who are not paying the full freight, is there going to be a subsidy from the city, the county, the state, the federal government to pay the difference to the developer?
It's not envisioned that there would be either a development or an operating subsidy. The vision is that the bonus itself would provide some economy of scale so that you could make up for that revenue loss, which would be a permanent loss.
Meaning what? Economy of scale, meaning what?
Well, that you can deliver the units for a little bit less per unit so that your total development cost would be a little bit less, and you could pass that along to the household that can only afford, say, $500 a month and not $1,200 a month.
So are the people paying the full freight subsidizing the people who can't pay the full freight?
Not in this case. In some cases, that would be the model. But in this case, no, it would be the land use incentive does the subsidy.
So the fact that they can build more on the same piece of land that they couldn't have done without doing this, that's the payoff for the developer.
That's right. And if it were mandatory and there weren't a land use incentive, it would be the market rate customers paying a premium in order to cover that shortfall. You're right.
So the city council wants to encourage affordable housing in affluent parts of the city. That's part of the language that's in the bill. Give us some examples of affluent areas in which the city wants to encourage this kind of housing.
Some of those would be primarily South Charlotte. And when we developed the density bonus, we looked at areas where the median home value was $153,000.
And that's the middle price. That's what median value means, correct? There are houses above that. There are houses below that.
Correct.
Why do we want to move people into affluent areas who are not affluent?
Well, as Fulton mentioned earlier about First Ward, that's a perfect example of not-so-affluent people living next to affluent people. Mm-hmm. I think we've learned from the old days of how public housing was developed that you don't want to put all poor people, if you will, in any neighborhood. We want people to be able to learn from each other. We want people to grow from their experiences, from their neighbor. We also want people to be able to live close to where they work.
Is First Ward an exception to the rule? In other words, if you're talking about putting this kind of housing in Ballantyne or Myers Park, if you're talking about doing that, isn't that different than putting it in First Ward? Because First Ward was Earl Village. It was project for poor people, and they raised it. And they put all kinds of – it's essentially a brand new part of town. Everybody who moved in there initially was new to that part of town pretty much. Is there a difference?
I don't think there's a difference. I think the question probably should be phrased, why shouldn't people of low income be able to live close by amenities? I think that, you know, the areas in which you're speaking, and I don't think that anybody's saying that anybody should be looking at only building in Myers Park or only building in Ballantyne. I think we're trying to build in areas where there are amenities, there are good schools for persons that are low income to take advantage of. If we're really trying to address the issue of generational poverty, I think some of the things we're going to have to deal with are, okay, well, where are some of the schools that are located that can really help those children move the dial a little bit on the fact of their education, because I think education is a big component of making sure that people have an opportunity for jobs in the future. And some of those areas happen to be in affluent neighborhoods. And I think that to the best of our ability, we should be trying to broaden the footprint of individuals that need these type of services and include them in these type of communities.
How do you overcome the not in my backyard syndrome?
I think it's continued education. I think it's there are many myths around affordable housing about who lives there, the behavior of people who live there. And we certainly recognize that there are going to be some bad apples, if you will. But when you talk about who needs affordable housing, it really is the teacher. It really is the police. It really is the firefighter. It really is many public sector employees. So I think we just have to continue to educate the community about who lives in affordable housing and what it is.
Is that the major misconception about who is actually there and who actually needs it?
I think that's one of the major misconceptions.
What are some of the others?
As Fulton mentioned earlier, it brings down property values. I don't think there are any studies that show that affordable housing, especially the way we build mixed income housing today,
right,
it certainly doesn't bring down the property value.
Because nobody knows who is and who isn't. Is that why it doesn't bring down the property value? You know that
actual structures that we're building are market rate structures, so you can't tell them any difference between them and the surrounding community, because we try to do it architecturally,
right,
to look like the buildings and et cetera that are in that particular
right
community. So you can't really tell the difference. And I think that when people hear, you know, subsidy, affordable, they automatically have a connotation of something that's negative. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that really is negative is a person's behavior.
Right.
And I think we need to take the stigmatism away from the fact of somebody needing a subsidy and really focus on behaviors. And that's what we're doing at the Housing Authority, is making sure that we're working with residents to make sure they understand what the expectations are in living in a mixed income community before we move them into a mixed income community. And really through design structure of, you know, roads and et cetera, and connecting communities and not having just isolation of a community, making it a part of a community, mm-hmm, get engaged with the neighborhood association, be a part of the community as a whole. And I think that is our best way of educating the community about the people in which the Housing Authority serves in general.
You mentioned First Ward. It's kind of a test case for this, because there are a mixture of people paying the full price and people, mm-hmm, who are using this as affordable housing.
Right.
Do you know what the ratio is of people in there who are using this as affordable housing versus those who are paying the full price? And how has it worked out? What's the track record in that development?
Well, the track record has been fantastic in development, and I think is roughly 40% that's affordable and 6% that is market rate.
Okay.
But the issue there is that the amenities that are there and the management that is there and the supportive services that are there has made the project the success. I don't think you could have one without the other in these type of developments. You need a great development team that comes together and understands how to put these kind of deals together financially. You need to have a good support system for the residents that were once there, because in general, you know, I believe the fact that when it comes to the term gentrification, we should be trying to minimize that by investing in those individuals prior to the development coming. So that means we have the supportive services and everything there for them. They understand what the rules, regulations, and et cetera are. So when the mixed income comes, then they're able to stay to the greatest extent possible.
As I was thinking about this yesterday, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, how do you make people comfortable with the fairness, the idea of the fairness of this? If I'm being asked to pay, I don't know, $1,500 a month for my apartment, and the person next door to me is paying $7 because that makes it an affordable unit, or if I paid, I don't know, $150,000 to buy a condominium in First Ward, and the person next door to me paid $80 because that's what they can afford, and it's an affordable unit, it's kind of like an airline seat. The person next to you may have paid full price, and you paid $47. And yet we don't question it. It's just the way the system works. Is that the way you anticipate people approaching this?
I would hope that nobody knows. Right. I don't know what my neighbor paid as far as their mortgage is concerned. When I lived in an apartment, I don't know exactly what the person beside me paid. What type of did they get in on the early bird special and they got, you know, 50% off, 30% off? You don't know those kind of things. And I haven't seen, at least in the developments in which the Housing Authority has partnered to build mixed income, that being an issue with the market rate families. I think at the end of the day, what they want to do is be able to have a great environment with amenities, okay, and live in a safe community. Mm-hmm. I think outside of that, I haven't seen any issues with individuals asking that question. Well, how much does Rudy make? How much is Rudy paying next door to me?
We have an email from Bo who says, the elephant in the room is that we have thousands of apartments and homes sitting vacant in the Charlotte region. Fill the vacant housing and help the existing neighborhoods. Yeah. You're all nodding in agreement with that.
Yeah, and Mike, the city council has had many discussions about that, and we certainly agree that there are many vacant multifamily properties in this city that could use some rehab. And I would just say that the city council is discussing ways to do that. How do we use some public subsidy, if you will, to go in and to rehabilitate some of those existing properties, have them used for affordable housing? Many of them are used for families who need affordable or mixed income housing. So I would just let Bo know that that is on the city's radar.
How many apartments are vacant in Charlotte?
About 5,000, and about half of those are in low to middle income neighborhoods, and most of those were built in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, mm-hmm. Oftentimes in East Charlotte and West Charlotte. In some cases, they have some deferred maintenance. In many cases, they're very well maintained. And I'd echo what Fulton said about the new deals in terms of the importance of quality design and the importance of professional management in making those properties be seamless and invisible in the community and being good neighbors.
If we have a deficit of at least 15,000 affordable housing units in terms of availability in the city, and we have all these apartments sitting vacant, why are they sitting vacant?
Well, they're sitting vacant because of the law of supply and demand, and maybe the rent is out of reach of that household, or maybe they prefer to live in a different location in town.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more on this and take some phone calls and read some more emails that have come in over the transom as we've been talking to Pamela Weidman, Ken Zemanski, and Fulton Meacham about the density bonus and affordable housing and the need for it here in Charlotte. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bylo Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Introducing new bonus fuel perks at Bylo with the Bylo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-lo.com. And Queen's University of Charlotte, where the McCall School of Business has recently been recognized by CEO Magazine. Details on the MBA at the March 13th info session, queens.edu. Montana's House of Representatives passed a bill that could imprison doctors for assisting in suicide. Legislation is pending in other states to make it legal. A panel joins Diane Rehm to talk about the legal and political debate over end-of-life issues in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The first 3 days of our spring membership drive have been eliminated thanks to you. We're now scheduled for a 7-day drive beginning on March 7th, but you can help buy back more by going to WFAE.org and pledging your support now. For every $55,000 raised, we'll eliminate another day. Now is your opportunity to shorten this drive. Pledge now at WFAE.org. Thank you.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Pamela Weidman is with us. She's Assistant Director of Neighborhoods and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. Ken Zemanski is Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. Fulton Meacham is CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. We're talking about affordable housing, the dearth of affordable housing, and ways to make more affordable housing available in more areas, and concentrating a little bit on the density bonus that was passed unanimously and without discussion by the Charlotte City Council. Density bonus allowing developers to put more units on a piece of property than they would if they didn't offer affordable housing in that property. Why was this passed without discussion?
Well, Mike, I want to be clear. It was passed without discussion because we had a year-long process with a very involved citizen advisory group. We also involved the City Council's Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee in a number of updates as we went through the process. So by the time we got to the opportunity for City Council to approve, they had been well informed. They had an opportunity to get all of their questions addressed. Our colleagues in the Planning Commission, they were very involved with us all along. So we answered City Council's questions as we went along the process to make it easy approval.
Let's take a phone call from David in Charlotte. David, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about the need for affordable housing. From my own personal experience, my wife is a police officer with CMPD, and I know that a lot of her fellow officers, because they can't afford to live in the Charlotte community, are predominantly living in the surrounding counties such as Harrisburg, Mooresville, Belmont, and these. And what flows from that is that you have officers living in predominantly white suburbs who are then turning around and policing predominantly black and Hispanic communities. And I think if there were more affordable housing, particularly for police officers, I think that there's just a benefit that flows from more than just the simple housing itself.
Talk about that. Do you agree with that?
I appreciate the caller's comment. I just think all of us are in some way affected by our environment. The more that you get an opportunity to spend time with people that are different from you, the more you understand that you're more like than different, and you're able to build relationships that way. And I don't think that this city wants to be in a situation of being resegregated, if you will, from the standpoint of race or income.
You bring up an interesting point because last week we had renowned sociologist and activist Dr. Frances Piven on the program to talk about her decades-long work and research with the poor and poor people's movements. And during that conversation, she stated that in her experience, she has found that people are afraid of the poor. That's because they don't know them. They don't see them.
Right. You know, Mike, I do agree with the caller's comment about if police officers could live in the city of Charlotte, perhaps if they could drive their police car home. And so the person who's even thinking about doing any harm or vandalizing the neighborhood, just the fact that that police car is parked in the driveway could go a long way. So I hope we can begin to attract more police officers to actually live in neighborhoods where they patrol. The other thing that I want to just point out is that we need to treat people who need mixed income or affordable housing, whatever we're calling it, we need to treat them fairly. These are working families. We need to treat them fairly. Just because they need some public subsidy doesn't mean that they're less than. So I just want us to keep that in mind as we talk about and think about who lives in affordable housing.
But if people are afraid of the poor, if she's right about that, and I know that she is, but if she's right about that, she has a lot more experience than I do, does that make this a hard sell for developers who want to have their units bought or rented?
For some, I think that, you know, we've been able to build relationships at the Housing Authority with a number of developers that do mixed income developments all across the country. I think you're going to have some that will and gravitate towards this, and you may have some that don't.
How do you market these units? Do you put a sign? Do you say that it's eligible for affordable housing? How would you say it? How would you let people know?
You probably want it to be as seamless and invisible as you can make it, and then you train your management staff in order to work with the qualified applicants and the units that are set aside for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to Andrew in Charlotte. Andrew, you're on WFAE.
Good morning.
Morning.
Why should Charlotte taxpayers have to subsidize the cost of labor for wealthy people in Ballantyne? If what you're saying is we have to build affordable housing there because the working class can't afford to live there, that's a labor cost. You know, if the employer can't attract someone to the job because they're not paying enough, they should have to pay more. And if you can't live where you work, they're not paying enough.
Can anybody comment on that? Because I can't think of a store in Ballantyne, but if you work at a store in one of the shopping centers out in Ballantyne, and you're getting a retail wage, which would be probably similar to what you would get at South Park or the former Eastland Mall, if you're working in retail, you could probably afford to live around the area in Eastland Mall, but you can't afford to live in South Park, and you can't afford to live in Ballantyne. So should retail clerks get paid more when they work in those areas? I mean, that's a philosophical question that you probably can't answer.
We've had community debates about minimum wage and how much housing you can afford with minimum wage. If you make minimum wage, you're going to have a minimal housing in all probability without a public subsidy. And, of course, a lot of the business community disfavor material increase in the minimum wage.
There are areas, you've already mentioned this, like Davidson and Chapel Hill, that make this kind of mixed income development mandatory. The city of Charlotte is operating under a voluntary arrangement, and this density bonus program, is merely an enhancement of a voluntary approach. If developers don't take advantage of this, if they don't take the city up on this, is Charlotte likely to pursue mandatory requirements in the future, given the need that we have?
Let me jump in with that. I think it's going to be a political debate. And we don't, with cities the size of Charlotte, Oklahoma City, Nashville, Jacksonville, Raleigh, we don't see mandatory approaches. You know, it's mandatory in Montgomery County, Maryland, San Francisco, a lot of the either more expensive or, politically different chemistry in those communities than in this one. But time will tell.
Now, other cities do it differently, even under voluntary programs. But according to what I read yesterday, history tells us that voluntary programs don't work well. They don't achieve the desired results. Is this something that the city thinks will work because it's a different model?
We do think that it will work. We are working really hard so that we can track the number of units that will be yielded through this. So time will tell, but we do think that it will work.
And if the incentives are a little bit deeper, like property tax abatement or waiving water and sewer tap fees, for example, some of which would require state enabling legislation, but if those were made deeper, it might sweeten the pot and be more of an effective carrot.
Prior to the recession, we talked a lot on this program about the need for affordable housing because development was running rampant and most of that development was for middle to upper income housing. Condominiums uptown, which cost an exorbitant amount of money, and then neighborhoods in the suburbs.
Those condos have converted to apartments in some cases, Mike.
Right.
Of the recession.
Did the recession put a damper on the need for affordable housing, or has it continued at a relatively steady level or even increased?
You know, the mismatch between low wage and the fair cost of housing is always going to be there, and it's there now just as much as it was before and during the recession. So the problem's not greedy landlords or lazy consumers. It's this gap between lower income and the fair cost of housing and the need for some subsidy. Otherwise, people are going to be paying a disproportionate share of their income for shelter or double up or live in poor quality places.
Last October, a consulting group, and God knows we pay consultants a lot of money, told the city that our greatest need is to find housing for our poorest residents. This density bonus, if I understand it correctly, does not target our poorest residents, correct? So why take action for those who have more income than what this consulting group that we paid for their advice for said we need to target?
Well, I think we want to have a number of tools. The Housing Authority, they do a very fine job at targeting the 30% and below. The city, we work with Crisis Assistance Ministries and Charlotte Family Housing to do some of that work too. But the purpose of this density bonus was to provide a tool for the private sector so that they could have a way of participating as well.
So you're relegating the poorest to the charity, to the charitable organizations. You mentioned Crisis Assistance Ministry. I mean, that's a charity. That is not the city. It's not a governmental organization.
Right. I guess the overall point is, Mike, the city can't do it we can't do it by ourselves. So this is a community issue. And so the density bonus, it's a tool for the private sector to participate. The Charlotte Housing Authority has a role that they play. And then some of the other nonprofits that we partner with, they have a role to play as well. Mm.
Lee emails that this is a citywide zoning change made that may greatly affect taxpayers' property values, often their single largest assets, without the taxpayers having the protection of the current zoning laws, open posted hearings. Talk about that. Well, you've said that this is not going to affect property values. How do we know that?
I mean, there have been studies that have been done when it comes to mixed-income communities, and especially the ones that that we've done here in Charlotte, that there has not been a negative impact on property values within the city.
When zoning changes are being debated, signs go up around the city, flyers go out to residents in the neighborhoods the zoning change would impact. Did this happen with this? Will this happen with this going forward, or is this a fait accompli?
There's not a lot of zoned land in South Charlotte for multifamily housing. So that means that an application for a conditional district rezoning will be necessitated. And often that's featured by the NIMBY argument. And when there's low income involved, it's made more heightened.
So I'm not sure I understand what you just said. Are you saying that if a developer decides to take the city up on this bonus, density bonus, that there will be posted hearings that residents in the surrounding area can participate in or not?
Only if they're looking to rezone, but they probably would look to rezone because there's a scarcity of zoned land now, zoned for multifamily in South Charlotte.
So what you're saying is right now it's difficult for developers to build apartments and condominiums because it's zoned for single family?
Or other uses, but not multifamily.
Okay. So how do you address that situation? If it's not zoned for multifamily and you're trying to encourage mixed-use multifamily development and you're providing density bonuses to developers to build that, but it's not zoned for that, how do you accomplish that?
Well, the developer would first have to get the property rezoned. I mean, the property has to be zoned properly in order for any type of multifamily to occur.
Okay. So you're telling me it's a two hill. You got to climb the first hill to get to the second hill, which is the peak. Is that what you're saying? You have to overcome the zoning laws as they currently exist for multifamily to be done, and then you can take advantage of the density bonus.
Right. So you have to be properly zoned. And then once you're properly zoned, you can take advantage of the by right density bonus.
Well, then will this density bonus, the potential for this density bonus coming into play in new developments, be something that stands in the way? Another tool in the arsenal of people who don't want any kind of multifamily development in their area, be it mixed development or just apartments and condominiums. They want the house with the picket fence next door to them. Will this be something they say we don't want? We really don't want it because of this density bonus.
You know, that can't be the basis for a land use decision in North Carolina, is that a proposal includes affordable housing. But it might be the ostensible reason, but not, the reason that's given by the elected officials.
You have mentioned deeper incentives. You think that deeper incentives might be necessary for apartment developers, condominium developers, to want to take advantage of the density bonus.
Yeah, go to their balance sheet and find out how much they're paying for property tax and water and sewer tap, and then compare that to the lost revenue that you'd have because you had a set aside of 10 or 15% of your units for assisted housing, and then make that carrot sweet enough and you're going to have some responders.
But you just said a few minutes ago that the very idea that they can build more units on a piece of property makes up for the difference of what they might lose by building that property and renting it at a lower rate.
No, it doesn't. So it doesn't make up for it. It doesn't make up for it. In and of itself, the increased number of units doesn't make up for the revenue loss, would be what people in the know with the numbers doing the math of apartment deals would contend that it's not enough.
So if you don't get these other incentives.
That's what our hypothesis is going forward, but we could be wrong. And it could be that certain developers that are more nimble and have access to other pots of money might do very well with this new program.
You obviously studied this for a while before you presented it to council and before council said yes to it. Is that correct? I mean, are these issues that you talked through at some point?
Yes, we studied this process for about 16 months with a citizen advisory group.
According to a city council report, providing affordable housing is considerably less expensive to social services as well as to private charities than providing shelter for homeless people. It costs $37,000 a year to provide shelter for a chronically homeless person. It costs only $14,000 a year through the Urban Ministry Center's Housing Works program, which includes Moore Place, which we've talked about on this program, and sites scattered throughout the city. Do you think people understand this, that this is actually a way not only to provide housing for people who need it at less expense to the city and its taxpayers and to the charities, and if they knew this, that they'd be more open to it?
That's a great point, Mike. I think often people don't understand that, and I would hope that people that would cause people to be more open to it. I would also hope people would be more open to it because, again, families who live in these units, they are working families. They just might not earn enough income such that they didn't have to pay more than 30% for their housing. But, again, I think more education, we continue to need that in this community to debunk some of those myths around affordable housing. So I hope as a community we'll continue to be open to more education.
Kamala Weidman is Assistant Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. Ken Zemanski, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, and Fulton Meacham, CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. Thanks for the hour.